Podcast.
Listen to The Organist, the culturally omnivorous, intellectually ravenous podcast from the editors of The Believer magazine.
Part of poetry is learning how to speak.
Chilly Billy, Chilly Billy.
I am also a horse.
I really value my life, even though I know it's debatable whether I'm even really alive.
The right reading for this is the one I'm giving you.
Find The Organist on KCRW.com or wherever you download podcasts.
From the Independent Producer Project and KCRW.com, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is a program of true stories and personal documentaries, and on this episode, Something Can't Be Everything. It's about an aspiring starlet and free-spirited hippie who hung out with movie stars, planned to be a star herself. Then one night she made a split-second decision, got in a VW bus, and went barreling down a path toward flowing white robes and a life in a spiritual commune married to a man who looked like God and called himself Yod. Robin Baker's tale comes to us from the always excellent podcast Everything is Stories, and a warning that some parts of the story reference sex liberally, so it might not be appropriate for everyone. From KCRW.com, it's Unfictional.
The only possession I own of my dead husband is this piece of his skull and a part of a robe that I made for him. It says 999. If you turned it over, it would say 666. Let me put this piece of bone away. Okay. All right. Whoop, whoop. Don't want to lose what's left of his skull. My name is Robin Baker. We're sitting here in Scottsdale, Arizona, first day of 2015. Maybe I should start where it started for me. It's in the 60s.
Revolutionary culture is a powerful revolutionary weapon in the broad masses of the people. It prepares the ground ideologically before the revolution.
Well, basically, I started singing and dancing before I could walk and talk. When I was about 13, 14, I started hanging out on the strip. And it was fabulous. Oh my God, do I miss those days. These days in Hollywood were unbelievable. There was so much going on. Everywhere you looked or went, there was something happening.
Just too much of everything. Glamour, fine foods, and the latest fashion.
Came performer at the Whiskey A Go-Go by the time I was 15.
And here's the world famous Whiskey A Go-Go on the strip. A favorite dancing spot for both the mods and movie stars who want to get it on. Let's drop in and see what's happening tonight.
The hottest rock and roll club on the West Coast. I mean, every band that really truly made it performed at the Whiskey, pretty much first. It was packed. Every night was something different. My best girlfriend in the world, Patricia Higgins, she and I were known as the White Witches of Hollywood. I had the dark hair, she had the blonde hair, and we used to dance. We used to go to the club and just dance on the dance floor. Dancing, getting high, going up into the dressing rooms, partying with famous people, trying to get somewhere, trying to get your name out there, trying to be known, you know, connecting with people so that you could maybe get yourself connected to what you wanted to do or become. I worked at the Whiskey A Go-Go for probably from 1964 to 1969, when I met my first husband, Jim Baker. He owned a number of restaurants on Sunset Strip and had just opened The Source in 1969 when I met him. The Source was a restaurant. It was the first of its kind, never been duplicated, raw, vegetarian, gourmet food restaurant, the best in the world. I was coming out of a period of being in the in crowd from this whole scene. I was trying to find myself, and I was out and about and walked up to Sunset and Sweetser. There had been a gay biker bar with pool tables and all this stuff at this spot. Nothing ever lasted at the corner of Sunset and Sweetser, but there was The Source. It was like this oasis in the middle of hell, of this rock and roll, you know, craziness. And there I found Jim Baker. One day I was sitting on the patio in my bikini, had just come from the beach. I could feel this force from the left behind me, this energy, and I turned around and there he was, staring at me. 6'4", 185 pounds of solid muscle, and I see this man who looks like Moses or Jesus or whatever. So much power, so much energy. That was Jim Baker. I just knew, uh-oh, something's happening here, and I don't think I'm comfortable with it. Then he walked up to me, I'll never forget this, with this blue pamphlet that opened up, and I was really stoned that day, and it had a foot chart with all the reflexology points. It looked like a railroad map to me. I didn't know. I was like tripping. So I took it, and he went, "You need to come to this yoga class." He said, "There's more for you in this life than what you're doing." And I said, no. I'm about to become a superstar. I'm on my way. I know everybody. That's where I want to be. That's what I want to do. And that's it, and that's all. He literally chased me around Hollywood for 6 months. Everywhere I went, Jim Baker would show up. This man was head over heels in love with me. He was nuts crazy about me, just out of his mind. And I finally asked him, "Are you stalking me?" "No." I said, "Well, why are you everywhere I go?" And he says, "Because you're my destiny and I'm your destiny." It was meant to be karmically that we were together. And the way it happened was, one evening, I decided to go see a group of friends of mine that I spent a lot of time with. I was hitchhiking. He was going the opposite direction. He was in his VW van and stopped at a stoplight at Sunset and Palm. And I had my thumb out going the other way, and he yelled out the window, "Robin, come to the yoga class with us." And I went, "Oh, God, if I don't go to this yoga class, this old man is never gonna leave me alone." So I said, "Hell with it. I'll get in the van. I'll go to the yoga class." I didn't go to see my friends at night. I didn't go make my usual rounds at night. I spent the night with Jim Baker, and he lived in his van. No sex. Didn't do any of that. Just stayed up all night and talked and got to know him, and I was just really blown away with what was happening, like the yoga class and talking about spirit and all this stuff. And the next morning, I remember I was sleeping in the bed of the truck finally, you know. At 5 a.m, I feel this bus take off like a bat out of hell. It's him. He's got to get up to the restaurant and open it and do his morning meditation. So we'll get up to the source, and he's teaching me how to make coffee for him, whatever. So I make the coffee. Restaurant had just been open a few months. It had opened April 1st, 1969, and this was August. And I went out front, and I got him a newspaper, and I saw the headlines, and I keeled over right on the cement on Sunset Strip. And he came running out to the street and picked me up off the cement. And he goes, Robin, are you okay? What happened? And I went, "Read the headlines. Just read the headlines." And he goes, "Oh my God." He goes, "What does this have to do with you?" I go, "This is where I was headed when I was hitchhiking and you talked me into going to the yoga class. And where I was going was to my friend Sharon Tate's house and my friends Wojtek Frykowski, Abigail Folger, Jay Sebring, who is my hairdresser and one of my best friends, were all up there that night with Sharon, who's 8.5 months pregnant, and Charles Manson murdered and slaughtered my friends.
They weren't born with the anger and frustration that they have. That had to be put on them by somebody. Somebody created them.
That was a shifting point for me that night. I had made a decision that it was like almost like God telling me, this is the path you should be walking down right now, because of everything that had transpired all the way up from the time I came out of the womb to the night that my friends were murdered, and I didn't go that night, and I went with Jim Baker instead. I kind of saw it as a sign that I was supposed to be with him, after all. He was 46. He was going to be 47 the following year, and I was 19, about to turn 20. He was 27 years older than me. The first time we made love, he told me, "You realize that I'm supposed to be a celibate." He said, "I want you to know that you are my wife. You are married to me if we have sex. That's it. So you have to decide, do you want me to be your husband?" And I just said, "Yeah." So for 3 months, we went to the BOTA in Los Angeles, the builders of the Adidom, the Temple of the Tarot. We took classes in Kabbalah 3 nights a week for 3 months so we could be married in a Kabbalistic wedding. Taking me out of my big-time hippie clothes, very revealing, into long white robes and turbans. We're all in white, in our white flowing robes. What Jim gave to me was he gave me something I never had, self-esteem. He showed me how much power I had, how talented and capable I was. He gave me a lot, and he literally worshiped the ground I walked on. He got what he wanted. He got me. When we had our wedding, it was like one of the most amazing days of my life because it was just so life-changing. Oh, my parents hated it. My father told me years later that if he had come to the wedding, he would have put a bullet in my husband's head. And my mother sat there crying the whole time while we were getting married. They were freaking out because my husband had committed 2 murders. The first guy he killed, I think he took the knife away from him and stabbed him. I'm not sure. And the second guy, he just used his hands and just snapped his neck, basically. And then he put a bullet in him, I think. It was truly self-defense in both cases. He was a pretty violent man by nature. He was a World War II Marine mercenary at the first siege of Guadalcanal on the first USS Chicago.
Battle for Guadalcanal, victory or defeat, destination unknown.
And a judo instructor for the judo instructors in World War II. But what a lot of people don't know is my husband also robbed 3 banks in his lifetime by himself. Set it up, did the deed, got away with it, blah, 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 blah. Not to open the source, but to open his other restaurants. I actually have a newspaper article somewhere in my house here with me in it, and it said my maiden name and explained that I was a hippie who gave up my life of sex, drugs, rock and roll for a positive life in Kundalini yoga. It was famous, and I was famous. Nobody could believe that I had left that life to be with Jim Baker, who was also famous. Everything in those days was so pure and so new. It was like something spoke to my soul. Deep down inside, I knew that I really wanted to be more than just a major star and what have you, that I was a really spiritual being and I really wanted to expand on that in my life. Why don't we start our own spiritual family? I said, you could be like the earthly spiritual father.
The snake comes into being out of its egg. All events are really one event.
We took the best of everything we had studied and put it together and created our own philosophy, which was a combination of many ideologies and different philosophies and, you know, all the people we'd studied from. And it was about doing no harm to any living thing. It was about not eating meat. It was about meditation. It was about breathing. It was about the Christ consciousness, believing in a higher power and not organized religion, you know, not causing harm to any human being, animal, place, or thing. Wanted to pull all the hippies off the street that were still in the drug culture, clean them up, have them become part of a higher consciousness. And people were just attracted. At one point, we got to be such large numbers that Jim and I both had an idea, why don't we all live together? There was like 140 of us at one point. We got our first big house together, was in Los Feliz, and it was the old Chandler Mansion. The people who owned the LA Times, that was their house, had been their house. And it had like 16 bedrooms with bathrooms. It was huge, a huge estate. Well, how people joined the Source family was you would come to a morning meditation and you were invited. And if you liked what you saw and you wanted to become a part of the Source family as it started to grow, then all you had to do was renounce your earthly life and become part of the family. And we had our garb, wore long white robes. In the beginning, a lot of us wore turbans still. Then it became a magus band, which was a white towel or rag or whatever wrapped around your forehead. We were to grow our hair, cosmic roots. You know, we didn't cut our hair. We didn't kill things. He started naming people. He changed his name to Father Yod, and then eventually it was Yehoah. Ah is the sound that a mother makes, and Om is the sound of the soul. My spiritual name was Ah Om. I was Mother Ah Om. I mean, you just see this man, this mountain of a man who looks like God walking down the street with all these men and women following him. A lot of people had different feelings about what was going on. I'm not exactly sure what they were. I think a lot of people thought that this was just bizarre. People thought we were a cult. I don't know what they thought. Jim and I both wrote a book together as husband and wife. It was called Liberation. We wrote the Ten Commandments for the Age of Aquarius, and we did all this kind of really cool stuff. And of course, my husband pretty much broke every one of the Ten Commandments. Like the sixth one, my favorite, a man and his woman are one, let nothing separate them. Boy, he blew that one. Well, the first couple of years were incredibly beautiful. They were amazing. What started out to be a pure and beautiful thing ended up to be a horrible negative nightmare, which still plagues me to this day. He was pairing people up. This woman's going to be with this man. And, you know, I even broke up married couples that came into the family. My husband started forgetting more about spirit and then got more into sex. I don't know where he got this in his head. Came home one day and decided that he was going to have more than one woman. He asked me how I felt, and I said, I think you're a dirty old man on a lust trip. That's what I think. He says, no, I have to father a super race of children, that it was God's calling. So he started trying to impregnate other women. I have no flippin' idea why my husband lost his mind and went there. I said, this is crazy. He never discussed it with me. He just announced it, which just broke my heart. It killed me. At some point, I said to him, am I not been an incredible wife to you? And he goes, yes, you have. And I go, do you not want to be married to me anymore? And he goes, of course I want to be married to you. And I said, well, why are you doing this to me then? Why do you have to have other women? Why? I was more than enough woman for any man. I mean, I did everything for this man, literally. I hand-separated his curls every day, his curly hair. I made his food like a piece of art with flowers and leaves on it and all kinds. I mean, I did everything. I made his clothes. I made his long robes eventually and all that. I mean, I did all that stuff for him. And all the dirty deeds that had to be done for 140 people that kept coming and going and the moving from the mainland to Hawaii and back and forth and to San Francisco or whatever we did, I was always in charge, basically. But now he had this group of people telling him he was God and this and that and what have you, and he just went to town with it. And I was gonna go divorce him and take my business and everything away and just make it all go away anyway. But I got pregnant finally. After I got pregnant, I couldn't leave my husband. I just couldn't. And then a year later, after I had my baby, he was dead. The year I was pregnant, it was still going kind of strong, but it was really starting to kind of go downhill. He got two other women pregnant while I was pregnant. Oh, he sold the restaurant without my consent in 1975 so that we could all move to Hawaii, and we were going to have farms and recording studio, and we're going to do all these amazing things. But none of this stuff ever manifested. So there was part of the family was in Maui for a while, and the rest was in LA, and then eventually we were all together, and we moved from island to island, basically. The Makapu mountain chain is about 22 miles of really ragged, sheer cliffs. And there's this one place called the Kualoa Ridge, which at that time was very big with hang gliders. One morning, in Hawaii, in Oahu, in 1975, August 25th, he got up and announced in morning meditation that he was going to go hang gliding. He had never hang glided before, and he wasn't in the shape that he had used to be in. My husband was 53 years old at the time. I was 24, almost 25. We were up at the top of the Kualoa Ridge in Waimanalo. I was on the ridge with the other women and a couple of the sons in the family. Well, actually, it was a fairly clear-skied, kind of windy day. I remember one of the hang gliders, who we dubbed the Black Knight, was up in the air, and he yelled down at my husband, "Father, don't jump yet." Before he jumped, he said, "If Jesus is the holy breath," he said, "the air will keep me up." And the minute he jumped, the air stopped. And he got sucked down into a vacuum. About 200 feet above sea level, he veered down into the Waimanalo campgrounds. We got down from the top of the Kualoa Ridge into the campgrounds at Waimanalo. By then, all the locals were surrounding his body. There was an ambulance there. I wanted him to get in the ambulance. He was still alive. He was breathing. I told him he needed to go to the hospital, but his women told him he was God and he did not need to go to a hospital. We didn't believe in doctors and all that. I'm sitting there, I'm watching him die. I'm praying to God that these crazy women, that I'll stop listening to them and he'll get into an ambulance and go get help. It was horrible. It was like I was watching his body shrink and I was watching this mountain of a man literally disappear in front of my very eyes. And he kept talking and talking and talking. He said, "God is greater than man, but in this instance, man is greater than God." He kept thinking he had broken his back. What I think happened is his lung got punctured, and I think that he had broken his sternum, and I think that his lung had collapsed, and he died because he kept begging for oxygen. Well, after about a year and a half, I broke the family up. I moved back to the mainland finally, and everybody kind of split up and went their separate ways. Some people stayed in Hawaii. Oh, it took me years to really reintegrate into the world. For about 7 years, 8 years, I didn't listen to a radio, watch TV, read a magazine, go to a movie, nothing. I remember after I came back to the mainland, I went to stay with my mother, and I went to her house with some people from the family, and I stayed with her, and she, you know, had the TV on and this and that, what have you. I had no idea who anybody was anymore. You have to understand, I was a Whiskey A Go-Go dancer. I was in the music industry, in the film industry. I knew everybody. I hung out with everybody. I went from this amazing life to not having that any longer. And then being so brainwashed by the lifestyle I lived with Jim and the family and what we had created, that I didn't know who I was. I went into one of the deepest, darkest places I've ever been in my life. I went into a depression that was so dark, was so black, was so deep, that it was almost impossible for me to come out. To this day, I am still missing parts of real life that I never got back. That's how immersed I was into that subculture. It's a crapshoot. I never truly know what somebody wants from me. I know certain people I know I can trust. And sometimes I always wonder what's in the back of someone's mind. Are they going to take this and steal it from me again? I still am afraid of that, of people taking my life from me. I still have fear. Reflecting back now, I'm very happy that I met Jim Baker. I don't regret it, but in a way, I just wish that it could have been different. I wish it could have worked out better and differently for me. And I wish Jim hadn't lost his mind and lost his way. This is the only thing that I was able to hide from everybody that was taking all my material possessions and stealing them. I was able to hide my letters. And I have letters that I wrote to him on the original source stationery. And I have letters that came back from him. So there's a ton of this stuff. They're on old paper. They're falling apart. And this was written 1/25/71. It says, "My dearest Robin, yesterday I returned from 10 days of test. The first phase of my ordeal is over. There will be a 10-day period of meditation and prayer now, followed by another excursion into the unknown. I am tired and weary. I feel like I've aged many years. All that has ever been Jim Baker must be destroyed." Then he writes, "I know all this, but to truly die while alive is not easy, my love. You are an inspiration to me. It is you who has given me the courage to go on. Your never-ending, failing devotion and love. I must achieve what you conceive me to be, for you are the perfect woman, wife, mother, daughter, child, friend. All the other women I have ever known were one or the other," and underlined, he wrote, "only you are complete. We have been bound together from eternity, and to eternity we shall return together. For we are one soul. May God continue to watch over you and bless you. In his name I ask it. I love you, Jim."
That story was produced by Garrett Crow, Mike Martinez, and Tyler Ray for the Everything is Stories podcast. Editing for Unfictional by Nick White. Music by the Filthy Huns. You can find more about the story at eisradio.org. I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional. The editor is Nick White, and the associate producer is Carla Green. You can follow us on Twitter at Unfictional and like us on Facebook. I do hope you'll join me next time for Unfictional from KCRW.com.